Hey, you go ahead and say it. The same. 77 right now in downtown Butler. I'm Tracy Morgan in the Next Tier Bank studios of WISR 680 AM. Next Tier Bank, your hometown community bank. Of course, you can always get us on Alexa now. Just download the Butler Radio News Skill. And then when you get the news skill, just say, Alexa, what's in the news? And you got us there. Dave Mullarkey's up next with It's Your Turn.
And now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn. Weekdays from 1230 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the It's Your Turn program for a Monday. We have a good show for you today. We have several guests with whom we're going to speak. We'll meet our first guest here in just a moment or so. Later on the program, we are beginning a series today of talking with top administrators in the school districts around our listening area. And we're planning to talk with the superintendents of all the districts. Now, that's quite a few, of course. But today we are scheduled to chat with the superintendent of the Slippery Rock Area School District, and that's Alfonso Angelucci. So I have not met Mr. Angelucci. We'll be chatting with him a little bit later on the program. And this is just general information about the school districts. If you live in the Slippery Rock District, you probably know a little bit about it. But if you live somewhere else, if you live in Saxonburg and the school district is South Butler or Mars or whatever, you may not know too much about the other schools. So we'll talk about the size of them, the testing. There's a lot of stuff at the beginning of a new school year. I understand that testing requirements are going to be changing here in Pennsylvania. Less concentration on testing. I don't know. We'll find out from Superintendent Angelucci whether that program has in fact gotten final approval or not. And then a little bit later on the program today, I can't think of being more timely with this, and quite frankly I'm so happy we were able to schedule a chat with Les Arbuckle today. He was he calls himself a military brat. I hope I'm not being disrespectful when I say that. His father was Naval Chief Petty Officer Bryant Arbuckle. And what a fascinating story. His father was stationed in Vietnam before the hot fighting broke out. This would have been in the early 60s. I have to get the exact timetable from Les. But I had no idea. I knew that we had American advisors there before the real hard fighting started. But I didn't know that their dependents went with them. And Les and his siblings, brothers, and his mother both went to Saigon with their father. And it's an interesting story even about his dad. His dad set up the radio station where Conrad, what was that guy's name? Conrad, Adrian. Oh, gosh, I'll have to ask him now. It's the guy that Robin Williams played in Good Morning Vietnam, the movie, about 15, 20 years ago. His dad actually set up that radio station. So we'll talk about it with Les. He has written a memoir about coming of age. He was like 14. Can you imagine being 14 and living in Saigon and your father was in the Navy? Great story. And why is it timely? The Ken Burns documentary series on Vietnam started last night on public broadcasting across the country. So anyway, that's later on the program today. Les Arbuckle joins us. Our first guest sitting right across the console from me, and gosh, it's a guy I haven't talked to in a while, and that's Trooper Dan Keston from the Pennsylvania State Police Troop D Butler Barracks. Trooper, good to see you, for goodness sakes. Well, nice to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. Good to see you, too.
I always like to talk with Trooper Keston a couple of times a year, usually. We usually concentrate on safety items. Sometimes it's something else that might be in the news of particular interest that the state police want to make sure that they get across to people. This, starting, I guess, yesterday, this is National Child Passenger Safety Week. For the rest of this week, there'll be an extra effort on the part of police and everybody else to make sure that everybody's using the proper restraints and so on for their kids in the cars.
Oh, yes, sir. It's a big week for National Child Passenger Safety, as you said. Police get involved with that. There's some other organizations that out there that advocate and do research and things for child passenger safety. So they're, it's a big week for them. The police involvement on our side is we out there, of course, always enforcing the laws with child passenger safety. But we do some special things during this time of year. We have a little bit of extra patrol out there looking for the violations, and also we have a child passenger safety seat check that we set up.
And you do that quite a bit, though, throughout the year, do you not?
Yes, but each state police station, we one day every month, we have a car seat check where people can call in and make an appointment to come, and then generally, usually twice a year, one during this week coming up. We do don't need an appointment. This one will be at the Cranberry Township Fire Department, and state police and some other people will be down there doing. There's no charge to it, but if someone would like to get their car seat inspected, they can bring it down and we can check their installation on it.
We can talk about how important that is in a moment or so. I didn't realize that you did. I knew you did this on a regular basis. I didn't realize it was quite that often. That's terrific. Sometime this year, I wanted to say it was this summer, maybe it was in the spring, you had one set up at Moraine Point out there by the Sam's Club parking lot, because I happened to be out there running errands that day. And, we had announced on the air that it was going to be there, and I drove right by. So, there it is. You had a little tent set up, and there were people stopping to get their car seats checked to make sure they had them stalled right.
Yes. And, you know, one of the big things now is with the laws and with the way these car seats are made, they're all made differently, and each vehicle, there's different things you have to be concerned about with getting the car seat installed properly. So it really takes somebody to read both in the owner's manual of the vehicle and the owner's manual of the car seat to get it installed properly. And even times then, there's still a mistake or two that's made when they're putting it in. So people like to double check themselves. And
there are honest mistakes. Sometimes people are a little lax when they're putting this in. They are complex. I've never tried to install one, but I've seen them. And there are latches and belts all over the darn thing. And if you don't get it in right, then you're not fully protecting your young child.
Yes, yes. Kind of like any other type of safety equipment, a motorcycle helmet's not really going to properly protect you if you don't strap it on, and if you don't put it on tight enough. And the same thing with the child seat. If you don't install it properly, it's not going to fully protect the child. And like you said, a lot of people do get lax. People I've found don't like to read all the time, and I mentioned it's very important to read that owner's manual with that car seat. And when people bring their child seats to these events, I can always tell who read their manuals and who did not. Like I said, even when people do read the manuals, there usually a lot of times there is still a mistake or two. But
some of these seats, and I don't have personal experience with them, but some of them come out, right? They double as like a carrier for particularly a young infant. So you're constantly putting them in, taking them out, putting them in. You can easily see how, and in some cases, an honest mistake would be made. Hey, you're in a hurry. You're running to the store. Yada, yada, yada,
Yes, yes. And always encourage people to just be as vigilant as possible when they're, when they're dealing with their car seat.
Let's go over, first of all, this is common sense, but it's also the law in Pennsylvania. Yes. And the law regarding car seats for young kids is actually a little more stringent than a lot of people might realize.
Yes, yes. And the main things, I get questions about that all the time. Just as you said, there are a lot of some stringent laws involved with it. So we do get a whole lot of questions of what is the law. A lot of people think it has to do with the height and the weight of the child. And those things do come in play, but that is only for that particular seat that child is using. So maybe before I get into the law, there is a sticker on the side. It's actually regulation by the government that car seat manufacturers put stickers on the side of their car seat.
And that's like step ladders these days.
Yes. And that will give the height and the weight limitation of that car seat. If that child exceeds either of those, either the height or the weight, that child is too big or too heavy for that seat. Mm-hmm. So you'd have to buy another one. But the law is not based off of that height and weight, but that is a common misconception out there. What the law is based off of is age. And a child that is 0 to 2 years old, according to the law, must be in a rear-facing car seat. So that car seat must face to the rear of the vehicle. That it used to be a child up to 1 year old. However, they just recently changed that. And there's a lot of fuss by the parents. Say, hey, look, my 2 year old just doesn't, child that's almost two just doesn't fit in their rear facing.
I can see their feet might be. Their legs are getting too long to be facing the rear of the,
Yes. And what the American Academy of Pediatrics says, and a lot of the advocacy groups for child seats, is that the child's feet and legs can touch the vehicle seat back.
Okay.
The only thing I would caution the parents is use common sense. Make sure the child's knees aren't too close to their face, because in a crash, those knees are going to come forward and things like that. So
I guess the main thing they're worried about is a neck injury.
We
commonly refer to as whiplash. That's probably not a medical term, but everybody understands that. That can be very serious in an adult.
Yes.
In a young infant. Well, hey, folks, how do you pick up a baby?
Yeah.
You always put one hand under the head.
Yes.
They're still pretty weak there,
Yes. Yes. Yep. Neck and back injuries is the main concern for that. So the law says 0 to 2 years old, that child should be rear facing. At 2 years old, the law says you can turn that seat around forward facing, and they must remain in that harnessed car seat until they're 4 years old. Once they are 4 years old, they can then go into a booster seat. And that booster seat, that's one of those seats you see that just kind of sits on the vehicle seat. There's no straps in it. Just
like a little bench, right?
Yep. Seatbelt wraps around it. They can go into that when they are 4 years old, and must remain in that until they're 8 years old. However, there is in the law that says that, a child, and always these ages, if your child still fits beyond these ages, best practice, keep them at whatever stage they're at until they're too big.
I guess, in fact, I was talking with Trooper Keston. If you're joining us a little bit late, welcome. Pennsylvania State Police Trooper Dan Keston is with us, and we wanted to talk with him because this is Child Passenger Safety Week. Now, just because you don't, maybe you're past childbearing age, you don't have kids that age, but this applies to aunts and uncles and grandparents and anybody else, too. This is, the law applies to the child that's in the car. And Trooper Keston was telling me, because I asked him about these booster seats, which is relatively new, I think, right? That's like within the past 10 or 15 years that this law was passed. When I first heard of it, I don't know what they were talking about, booster seats for kids up to 7 and 8. And so I asked Trooper Keston, what's the purpose? It's all trying to make sure that the seatbelt does not fall in a dangerous place and harm the child in the event of an accident.
Yes, that is correct. A seatbelt, sometimes when a child is too small to sit in a vehicle without a booster seat, that seatbelt will come across that child's neck, their throat area, their face, things like that. So, of course, common sense tells us, you don't want that, because in a crash, that could cause serious injury. And you definitely don't want to put that shoulder strap behind the child either, because then the seatbelt isn't going to be doing its job either. Another thing that you have to look at, too, is that the lap portion of the seatbelt. It should go across, just like the name implies, the child's lap, mm-hmm. which is where the upper thigh meets the lower hip.
Where the bones are.
Yes, yeah. yes, yeah. yep. And same thing with, yep. And so what we need to look for is to make sure that lap portion is not going across the child's stomach. Or their abdomen area, because when a child is too either short or sometimes a very thin child, goes across their abdomen, and as you can imagine in a crash, all those crash forces on a child's abdomen would just be horrific.
Yeah, you're too far. You're above the pelvis. Pelvis is that?
Yes.
Yeah, the pelvis.
Yes.
Bones, which take the force if you're in a crash. If you get above that, there's no bones in where you're.
Yes.
Stomach and your liver are and everything like that. If you're below the ribs and I think everybody sees what you mean. I didn't understand the top part, the shoulder part of the seatbelt. I know of people, there was somebody, I think it was an aunt of mine years ago, whenever they first started making the shoulder, the first seatbelts didn't have a shoulder strap.
Yes.
Can you remember those?
Yes.
They just went around
lap.
Your lap.
Yes.
And you could even, if you had an older car that didn't come with seatbelts, you could buy them and put them in, because it was just a lap belt, yeah. like on a plane.
Yes.
Okay. And then, of course, this is a long time ago, but they came out with the shoulder portion of the. I had one car. I don't remember what car it was. Some Chrysler vehicle, where they had this design that would automatically enclose you in the shoulder belt. It was the dumbest thing. Maybe you saw one of these. You would get in, and the shoulder, when you opened the door, the shoulder belt would go up next to the windshield on the top of the car, and when you closed the door, it was on a little track, like a sliding door, and this thing would go sliding back, kind of lock you in. It didn't work. But at any rate, there was someone in my family, I think it was one of my aunts, she was kind of a small woman, and when they started to have those shoulder belts, it hit her in the neck.
Yes.
And she wouldn't wear it, because she said it's painful. Not if you're in a crash, but just driving down the road.
Yes.
So I can see what you mean. You put this little booster seat in there for smaller kids. They're not infants or toddlers anymore, but they're still elementary school kids.
Yes.
And it boots them up to the right height for the shoulder strap and the lap belt.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yep. Are people using these things?
Yes. It's a lot of people. We talked before the show. We see, years ago, parents didn't really use these things. And,
yeah.
I remember as a child jumping back and forth over the front row and the back row seats just kind of having free roam in the car. Mm-hmm. But vast majority of the people are complying with these laws. And I think it's just the education that's been put out there, and I think people understand that a child isn't going to hold up in a crash if they're not properly secured.
I think also it's become standard procedure now for even the past generation or two. I've seen kids, families get into cars, even older folks, and they just automatically buckle up. They could be going down the street to church or to the grocery store a couple of blocks, and they just automatically buckle up.
Yes.
It's probably the people that don't use seatbelts are older generations by and large, eh?
Yes, I think that's a pretty good assumption. And with the car seats, too, I know law enforcement, there's a lot of guys out there to give some breaks from time to time with the motorists as far as, speeding or stop sign or turn signal violations. But I don't know of any police officer that really is willing to give a break when it comes to securing a child in a vehicle. So, I think that kind of helped a lot, too.
Is this, and I don't know the right terminology for this, Trooper Dan Keston, but when Pennsylvania's seatbelt law became mandatory, I don't know when it was... It's long after we had seatbelts, but it became mandatory it is mandatory, right?
Yes.
It's the law. But for a while, it was like a secondary offense. I'm sure that's not the right term. But if someone were, let's say, pulled over for speeding and the officer saw that they weren't wearing their seatbelt, then they could charge them for not only for speeding but not wearing a seatbelt.
Yeah.
And then is it still secondary, or can you be stopped just to driving down the street without a seatbelt?
It's still a secondary offense if the police officer believes the unsecured person is over 18.
Okay.
If you have this front seat occupant that you see doesn't have their seatbelt on, if as a police officer believe that person to be over 18 years old, then it is a secondary violation. However, if you believe that person to be a child, somebody under 18, then it can be a primary violation.
Okay, and you can be cited for just that.
Yes.
Not for anything else.
That is correct, yes, sir.
What other questions do I have? You wouldn't think this would be so complex, but it really is. Somebody found out you were going to be on the show with me today, and they said, what about rear seat passengers? Or even in some vehicles, a minivan or a large SUV, there is a third seat.
Yes.
Do you have to wear a seatbelt if you're in a back seat of a vehicle?
If you are under 18, any seating position, that person must be buckled. However, if somebody is over 18, the front seat passengers have to be. So if you're over 18, the law doesn't say that you need to be secured in a rear seat.
Doesn't it make sense, though, Trooper?
Yeah, yes, yes.
And you've seen accidents where people, I hear about them all the time, where a person is killed simply because they weren't wearing a seatbelt.
Yes, that's true, and I always tell people to take consideration. And before I move on to that, like you said, I mean, we respond to a lot of crashes that roll over, several times, and you get there, and the occupants are all standing next to the vehicle, but and they had their seatbelts on, and you go to other crashes that doesn't really appear to be a whole lot of damage to the vehicle, but you have somebody deceased inside because mm-hmm. they weren't belted, so. As a police officer, we definitely see the value in them every time we go to a crash. But, we also, I tell people, too, if you're unbelted in that vehicle, you put anybody else in that vehicle at risk because that seatbelt prevents ejection from your seat. So if somebody's unbelted in the back seat and you get into a frontal crash, well, that person's going to go forward. You have other people sitting there. If it's a side impact crash, they're going to shoot across the vehicle. So if you don't have that seatbelt on, not only do you put yourself in danger, you put others in danger because, your head could strike theirs, or your elbow or your knee can strike their head. And also, I always like to talk to people about securing items in their vehicle, especially when, Child Passenger Safety Week. I like to really stress this, but, if you have a stroller, we advise people, don't just throw it in the back of the minivan. Don't just sit it in the back seat next to the child, because in a crash, that stroller or that gallon of milk or that can of soup or whatever it might be, that the tools that you were transporting in your car, all those things can become projectiles and strike other people, and especially when you have a small child in there. So secure it the best way that you can. If you have an SUV, I know they make tie down nets, and
most of them come with a net, or you can get bungee cords. There's 18,000 different places where you can hook them on back there.
Yes, and if you have a passenger car, we recommend put those types of things in your trunk, because people do get injured and also killed by, items that are in a car.
Something I never thought about. And a stroller, if your family has a young child or an infant or a toddler, you're going to be hauling a stroller a lot. I never thought about that.
Yes.
Yeah. So weapons inside a car. And boy, how many accidents do we hear about? You see them. I hear about them. Where people are ejected. I think a lot of average folks don't realize the force that's involved in a high-speed crash, because so many times I hear people being thrown out of vehicles, right through a window.
Yes, yeah, it's something that is more common than most people would think.
Yeah.
And that's what a seatbelt does, is prevents that. And when you hear on the news that somebody died of, blunt force trauma from a crash, basically what that is saying is that, that person's organs were basically, you know, driven against their body cavity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's what that, you know, when I mentioned that blunt force trauma. So you can imagine the force that it would, you know.
How many times have you even, I don't know, you're pulling out from a stop sign or something, even in the city, you're barely moving, and you have to hit the brake real hard, you know, and a dog jumps out in front of you or something. Have you ever noticed how you, the inertia, even when you're hardly moving,
yes,
you know, or something sitting on the front seat beside you, and it goes crashing to the floor when you hit the brakes, and you're not even going very fast, hardly moving. Imagine if you're at speed, the force there.
Yes, and it's definitely apparent. And today's cars are engineered in a way, you know, a lot of people say, oh, cheap, you know, it's not like that 74 Falcon that I used to have. It was made out of steel. But a lot of that flimsiness in these newer vehicles is actually designed to absorb a lot of the stress. But, you know, we tell people, you know, seat belt and all that engineering that goes into this, you know, those are good at regular speeds. And we're talking about force as we are. I'd like to remind everybody, you know, speed just increases that force. So those engineering, you know, features and those seat belts, they're only good up to a certain point. You know, at regular travel speeds.
Is it still recommended that you, if you attach a car seat appropriately, correctly, that you still should put the infant or the toddler in the back seat as opposed to the front?
That is correct, yes. And in fact, the rear center position,
okay,
basically the centermost position in the vehicle, is the safest for the child. Just kind of gives them that extra space, you know, all the way around. But I will say, you know, like myself, I'm a taller person, so I need to push the driver's seat back so that I can safely operate the pedals and the steering wheel, mm-hmm, and things like that. So sometimes, especially a rear-facing car seat, can interfere with moving that seat all the way back. So if you are a very tall driver, you know, just make sure that you can get that seat back far enough so where you can safely operate the vehicle. If not, you may have to move that seat to the passenger side or whatever. But yes, that centermost position in a vehicle is statistically shown to be the safest.
What about airbags? Some people say, well, my car has airbags now, I don't need to worry about a seatbelt.
Airbags, you definitely still need, because, you know, you really don't want that airbag to strike you, for one thing. And, you know, that airbag's just there as an extra safety feature, shouldn't be used as the primary one, just an extra one, which also makes it very important not to use a child seat's rear-facing ever in a front seat, because that airbag on a rear-facing will strike a rear-facing baby seat.
Whenever it goes off.
Yes.
And by the way, that's a last resort. You don't want the airbag to go off. People actually can sometimes be injured.
Yes.
So when the airbag explodes is what it does, quite frankly. That's literally what happens to it. Yes. And, it might save your life in an extreme situation, but you don't want to be hit in the face with that thing unnecessarily. So
yes,
buckle up.
Absolutely.
Buckle up. The state police are emphasizing this week during Child Passenger Safety Week. Something else I wanted to ask you about. Oh, yeah. If you're a grandparent or an aunt or an uncle, you need to make sure that you have one of those benches, what do they call them, booster seats, if you're hauling you know, the elementary school kids around.
Yes, absolutely. Somebody between ages 4 and 8, if you just pick them up and drive them a mile or two down the road after school or whatever, you still need to have that anytime you transport that child. And a booster seat, something easy to, you know, to change from vehicle to vehicle. It just, mm-hmm, kind of sits on a seat, and a seatbelt pretty much just wraps around it.
It's
so
not tied down or anything.
Correct.
Like that.
Yep. Yeah. So nice and easy. You know, probably wouldn't even have to buy your own. Maybe you would out of convenience, but something.
I'm sure that's what happens with the for the infants and the little ones. They just take the car seat from mom and dad's car and,
yes,
put it into grandpa's. You know.
Yep.
Whatever it is. Yeah, that's interesting you would mention neighbor. I can remember when I was in elementary school, on occasion, if a neighbor passed me, I lived at the end of a very, very long street, was not uncommon for a neighbor to stop and pick me up and,
yes,
drive me the last half mile or so.
Yeah.
Different world we live in today,
yes,
huh?
Yes.
Yeah. Different world. Trooper Dan Keston visiting with us here today. on a very, very important subject. And even if you thought before we started talking about this that you knew everything there was to know, it's good to get a little refresher every once in a while about this. And for heaven's sakes, if you have any question whatsoever, you know, do I have this thing installed safely? Am I all right? Get it checked out.
Yes. Yep. Like I say, you can call up to the barracks and
you do it for free, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Make an appointment, or like I said, this coming Saturday, the Cranberry Township Fire Department will be there, and no appointment needed, and no charge for that.
Excellent, Trooper Dan Keston. Good to see you again.
Thank you very much for having me.
We have to get together in person more often. I see more on TV anymore than I do in person. By the way, how is it that you, because Troop D is the Butler Barracks, right?
Yes, sir.
But that's a couple of different counties, technically, right?
Yes, Troop D is the headquarters. So Troop D is actually a five-county area, Butler, Mercer, Lawrence, Beaver, and Armstrong.
So that's why we see you on Pittsburgh television every once in a while.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Are you the official spokesperson for all of those five counties?
There are me and Trooper Long and Trooper Black are, yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Well, good to see you in person.
Well, thank you again for having me.
Sure. Trooper Dan Keston. Okay, take a break. When we come back, our next guest will be visiting with us, and it is the superintendent of schools in the Slippery Rock Area School District. And we'll be happy. I've not met him before, so I'll be happy to talk with Superintendent Angelucci. He's next on It's Your Turn here on WISR. Stick around. We'll be back in just a minute.
Thompson Miller probably receives more calls about cremation than any other subject. So let me share with you what you need to know, what you need to think about concerning this sensitive subject. Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler is often asked these points. Should you consider cremation for your loved one? Is it appropriate for your family? What's the appropriate funeral service? What's the cost? Good questions. Cremation offers three advantages: simplicity, convenience, and it's local. Thompson Miller's cremation services are right here in Butler at our own newly created facility. We assure you that your loved ones will never leave our care at any point in the process. Let's talk it over privately right here at Thompson Miller, or call us at 724-287-3706, 287-3706, or online at www.thompson-miller.com. Thompson Miller at the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Thompson Miller, time-honored excellence.
Welcome back, good friends. Nice to chat on the first portion of our program today with Trooper Dan Keston. And our next guest is going to be interesting as well. We have the superintendent of schools in the Slippery Rock Area School District with us. And that is Dr. Alfonso Angelucci. Sir, nice to meet you. We've not met before, so let me give you a virtual handshake here through the ether, okay?
Sure, sounds good. Nice to talk to you, Dave.
We are in the process of, we're going to be chatting with the top administrators in all of our school districts in the region. We haven't done this for quite a while, so I thought with some changes that are happening in the world of education that it would be a good time to just, over the next couple of weeks, we're not going to do this every day, but over the next couple of weeks, schedule a chat with all of the top administrators. And we'll just, it's just general information about the district and some of the changes that are going on. And one thing I want to talk to Dr. Angelucci about is the testing changes and the requirements from Harrisburg. I think they're in the process of being changed. A little bit first, though, Dr. Angelucci, about the Slippery Rock Area School District. What's your general footprint? You go all the way down to Lake Arthur, right?
We actually go down to the Portersville. That's the Portersville area. That's the southern part of our school district, and the northern part is actually all the way up to Harrisville.
So you have quite a wide geographical footprint, then, huh?
It's actually 140 square miles, yeah.
Oh,
so it is. It's pretty. It's so big. I'll tell you, Dave, that we have to have two different bus companies, a northern and a southern transit company, to serve all our students.
Well, that's something I didn't know. Already, I've learned something here. And that, you know, from a standpoint of the taxpayers, which you always have to think about, we have 140 square miles in your school district. That means transportation costs are going to be probably higher than most districts, I would imagine, huh?
Well, you know, and Dave, in Butler County, most of the school districts are about that size as far as geographic area. So
didn't know that.
Yeah, we're all pretty similar in size, I would think.
So if you go all the way down to Portersville, then your district actually goes south of Moraine State Park and Lake Arthur.
A little bit. Yeah, just a little bit south. We actually touch the Elwood City Area School District. We border them and the Laurel School District there in Lawrence County.
Ballpark figure on the student population in the K through 12 in Slippery Rock?
We are actually, we're right about 2,000. I think it's actually 1,950, mm-hmm. but, you know, tomorrow it could be 51, right? Yeah. But we're just under 2,000 students in our school district.
The population of most school districts in Pennsylvania has been declining slightly. In fact, the last population numbers that I saw, or the last statistics that I saw, showed only one school district in Butler County that was gaining in student population. That was Mars, because they've had a lot of people move in from just over the county line into from Allegheny County into Butler County because lower taxes. But that was the only school district that, at this point at least, was growing in size. Have you had a slight decline as well?
We actually, yeah, we've had a slight decline. I think this is the first time that our school district has been under the 2,000 mark, even though it's only 50, but I believe this is the first time we've dipped under 2,000 in quite some time. So I guess if I would ask a few of our historians here in the school district, they might remember, but it's been a while.
Yeah, and by the way, this is nothing against, certainly nothing against the Slippery Rock District or any individual district.
Oh, no.
This
right.
is the demographics of American society. And, you know, it's happening all over.
Sure.
Families are having less kids. You know, it's as simple as that.
That's right. Well, if you think of even, you know, you think of the city of Butler, and this is the way I can sometimes will give the example of cities like Butler or Newcastle. If you look at it, kind of view it as a dome, and all those houses at one time, they all had three, four, five, more than five, six, seven kids in each under each of those rooftops, and now, you know, that's not the case anymore.
Yep.
So.
Yep. And that's being felt. That change in demographics is being felt not only by public school districts, but by institutions of higher education as well. In fact, they're the ones that are really getting hit right now.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Except for, I think, Slippery Rock and Westchester.
It's true. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, Slippery Rock's the only university in western Pennsylvania that's showing. In fact, they had record enrollment last year.
I believe that's
SRA.
Right. And I'm a Slippery Rock University graduate myself, and from back in the 90s. But between then and now, I believe they've grown about 2,000 students there. So
yeah.
They're a good neighbor to us too, by the way, Dave. It's pretty unique to be a school district that's part of a college town, and this is my fourth year in the district, but we've grown to be we've grown a really nice partnership with the university that I'm really proud of.
And you figuratively can say they're a nice neighbor. In your case, it's literally a nice neighbor. They're just across the street, for goodness sakes.
Exactly, yeah. That's right.
What is that? Keister Road separates the two?
Yep, that's it. Keister Road.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So a little bit, listeners, if you're joining us a little bit late, that's fine. Dave Malarkey is my name on this segment of It's Your Turn. We're getting just kind of an overview of the Slippery Rock Area School District, and we're chatting with the top administrator there, the superintendent, Dr. Alfonso Angelucci. A little bit about the structure of your school. I know that so many districts have, in some cases, markedly adjusted their structure, mainly by consolidation of elementary buildings. You have, well, there's a high school. You have a middle school up there,
too.
We
have a middle school, yeah. And we have two neighborhood elementary schools. Now, Dave, I got to tell you, that's becoming something that's very unique these days, is for school districts to maintain their neighborhood elementary schools. We have one in the southern part, our Moraine Elementary School, and then up in the northern area, we have our Slippery Rock Area Elementary, and they're both K through 5 elementary schools. They're not grade centers, which is what a lot of school districts around us are moving toward, but we're still maintaining those two, what we call neighborhood elementary schools.
And then your middle school would be?
That's grades 6, 7, and 8.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, that's your newest physical plant, isn't it, in terms of your buildings?
I believe so, yes.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Slippery Rock High School, although it has quite the new look over the past several years, it's undergone some renovations. In fact,
well, with the stadium and the auditorium, we did some renovations there. I don't know how many people have been able to check out our stadium, which is actually in its fourth year already. I still consider it new. But it's a beautiful facility for our students and for our community also, and we get a lot of use out of the stadium.
That is one of your more visible recent renovations. I know right after that was done, I was driving along 173 there, the Centerville Pike.
Oh, right.
And,
yes,
and it sits up quite a bit higher than your. The topography of your high school campus, and I looked down and I thought, wow, does that stadium and that new field ever stand out? You could probably see that from the surface of the moon.
Beautiful. It actually, it's pretty striking. You're right. It really is. They did a great job in the planning of it and in the forward thinking of it also with the many different athletic groups, physical education classes and events and such. I got to hand it to the school board and the business manager, Paul Sesser. They did a fantastic job in planning the whole thing.
Talk a little bit about that, because that, from what I've talked with other administrators, there's a lot of people in the general public that don't understand what a beautiful stadium, and in your case, a well-designed stadium and athletic field, how that can actually be a good use of taxpayer dollars. A lot of people just think that a stadium is used for football games, you know, 5 times a year, and that's it. My goodness, that's used for multiple different sports. It's used throughout the entire school day, isn't it?
It sure is, yeah. Even physical education classes, middle school and high school, they can use it. The soccer teams use it. In the spring, Dave, when it's very rainy and muddy, the baseball and softball teams are even able to go over there and get in some practice outside when there might be some other districts in the area that might not be able to do that because of the mud and the grassy surface. But that's also a big advantage.
Well, and it's savings once you. Get the initial expense. It's a huge savings on maintenance.
Maintenance, correct.
Cutting the grass, fertilizer, watering, reseeding, and all that stuff.
Yep, absolutely right.
Yeah. We're talking with Dr. Alfonso Angelucci. He's the superintendent in the Slippery Rock Area School District. We're getting kind of an overview today. You mentioned your business manager. I don't know of any school district today that operates without one. There are just so many responsibilities for the top administrators. You have too many educational decisions to make. You can't be worried about what company the pencils are coming from, right?
Well, we're always worried. I'm always worried about that sort of thing. But, you bringing up our business manager, he's got to be one of the best in the state. Now, I mean that sincerely. He's been here for a while, and it's nice. He's somebody who knows the community and keeps such a great watch over the taxpayer dollars, which you also mentioned earlier. And he and I just we work very well together.
Do you have an assistant superintendent in the district?
Do we ever? We have Dr. Patricia Cardenbeekus, and again, I you'll probably get tired of me hearing me brag about these guys, but Dr. Cardenbeekus is she has brought in thousands of dollars just in grants, grant writing, and seeking out of grants that she's been able to find. She also oversees our wellness programs, some of our nursing and counseling programs here in the district, and there's things that sometimes maybe they might go unnoticed by those in the community, but those of us who get to see how those programs affect the lives of our kids and how it helps them educationally, it's something we greatly appreciate here.
I was, and I don't know whether you still have this position. I was looking at, I guess it was your website I was examining. It looks like you have a school psychologist on staff. Is that still the case?
Yes. There's some school districts that actually contract that service out, Dave. If we have students that it looks as though they're struggling in the classroom and they might need testing, Our school psychologist will handle that, what we call a multidisciplinary evaluation for those students. And he pretty much is a various tests to pretty much rule things out, you know, and try to find out what's going on with that kid so we can serve them the best we can. And there are times when those students then end up in the special education tract as a result. Not all the time, but sometimes that happens, and the school psychologist is integral in that whole process.
Do you have, speaking of tracks, do you have, and I don't know, this might be old school. I mean, this might be out the window by now. I have no idea. Do you have multi-tracks when you get to the high school level?
Well, we have departments, and I mean, all through our grade levels, K through 12, what we really strive for, Dave, is what we call differentiating the instruction, and okay. Our teachers are expert, really, in finding where our students' strengths and weaknesses are, using various test-taking data, and screening the students and finding out where their points of weakness and strengths are, and then differentiating the instruction to fit their needs.
That's so important. That's why when I saw that you had a school psychologist, I said, wow, I put a little star beside that. I wanted to make sure and ask you about that. That can make such a difference. There was a time, not all that long ago, where, you know, a lot of times if a student was having trouble, they were just, you know, automatically assigned to one track or another. It may have been a learning disability that could easily have been taken care of. It may have been a student that was somewhere on the autism spectrum and nobody realized that. My goodness, the earlier that you can identify that, what a change it makes in the quality of a student's life and education.
It absolutely does. And, I mean, I had talked about our assistant superintendent earlier, but and the partnership with the university, but we actually have partnered with them for a community innovation zone grant. The assistant superintendent and the early childhood department over there at SRU have worked on a grant that actually brought some planning with local daycares, preschools, our kindergarten teachers, our primary grades together to utilize some of the resources we have on hand to better meet the needs of our early learners, even before they come to kindergarten.
Hmm. What about testing? I wanted to make sure and ask you about that because I'm a little bit unclear on where we stand right now. The last time I remember reading a news story about this was, I believe it was this summer, maybe late summer, where word out of Harrisburg was that they were going to be issuing a directive that the spent less time on testing and preparing for tests and more time learning. Has that, in fact, become the, you know, the law of the land, or is that still being discussed? Or because, you know, there are a lot of educators who thought there was just too much testing going on.
Well, that is, from my level all the way down and all the way throughout the system, is something that we saw was that there was too much time, as you stated. There was just too much time being spent on the assessments, and now they are to decrease that somewhat, and we are supposed to see that, I believe, coming this spring, actually, which will be, it'll be nice that we focus more on the instructional side. We're always going to have to assess our students. I mean, when you and I were in school, Dave, we had to be assessed on one test or another, just so that they could get an idea of where we fell as learners. But it does seem that there's been an overabundance of that in recent years.
Yeah, what I remember from my elementary and junior high days, we took an achievement test, I don't know,
right,
every other year or something like that, and then but that was it, other than, you know, when you were a junior in high school, you took the PSAT, and when you were a senior, you took the SAT.
That's it.
And that was it.
Yeah, and those are what they call norm-referenced tests, and now we have norm-referenced tests that kind of gauges and compares us across the other states nationally, but now we even have criterion-referenced tests, which actually test the state standards that are part of our curriculum here in the school district. So it makes it a little bit more specific. But again, like you stated, there's just been an overabundance of that, and it's nice to see that the representatives in Harrisburg, the governor, you know, they're working together and they're listening to what professional educators are telling them in that regard.
Well, I have no professional training in education, but I can remember seeing, and I got to be honest with you, Doctor, I don't even remember what test it was, whether it was a PSSA or the whatever. It was the one,
right,
where they issue government ratings, and you know, they were issuing ratings for schools, and some people were getting very upset, and there were educators who were saying, well, you know, this is not really fair because we have to include certain people in our track, for example, that are, you know, we could work with them one-on-one for the next 10 years, and they're never going to get above their efficiency rating in reading. It's just not feasible. Is that still in place, those government rating things?
Yeah, they are. There's been some modifications to those too, and I think we're going to see more of those coming in the future, with actually what they call the Future Ready Index. Right now we're utilizing the School Performance Profile. And you know, in education, Dave, I'm sure you've seen this even reading the newspaper, we have more acronyms. It's alphabet soup all over the place. But yeah, that is something that you'll be hearing more of, I think, is something called the Future Ready Index.
Here's something that's changed a lot since I was in school, and I suspect you too, Dr. Angelucci, and that is equal opportunity for girls in sports. There was hardly anything in terms of interscholastic activity for girls whenever I was in school.
Well, I don't want to compare our ages for sure, Dave, but now there were quite a few opportunities, as I recall, but there are definitely more now, and that's a good thing. You know, the more opportunities that we can give all of our students, you know, the better, and especially in a school district our size, I think we do an excellent job, and the school board has embraced that. The school community seems to be on board with it. We're doing things with robotics now. We have a robotics team, and both boys and girls certainly are welcome to be a part of that. Of course, we have, you know, all the traditional sports as well, and I think extracurriculars are an important part of school, whether it's the elementary grades or the high school grades. Anything that makes them feel a part of their school, feel pride in their school. I think all of those things tie together to make a positive educational experience for
kids. I couldn't agree with you more. And I cringe when I hear some people, you know, when it comes to budget time, talking about, you know, taking the knife to some of those activities. Those are important in esprit de corps, community spirit, spirit among the students. I mean, it could be athletics, it could be the school play, it could be marching band, for that matter. Slippery Rock is, was it, Red and gray? Is that the colors, generally?
You got it, yeah.
Red and gray?
Yes, it is.
Well, I'll forgive you for being too close to the Ohio State Buckeyes with those colors. But
yeah, that's okay. I agree with you.
No, it looks sharp at a parade or something when I see the Slippery Rock Marching Band come
rolling
down.
We wear it much better than Ohio State does, though.
I would agree with you on that, 1,000%. Do you still have, this might seem like a silly question, but do you still have food service within the district? Because I think some schools now contract that out.
Actually contract out through Aramark, uh-huh. And I'm sure you've heard of that company. I believe they that either PNC Park or Heinz Field or maybe even Three River Stadium long ago, they had contracted. That's contracted with them, and that's, I think, what some people equate the name Aramark with, but that's mm-hmm. who we contract with.
Well, and that can be, in many cases, overall a money saver. Just like many districts have contracted out their tax collection over the past several years to companies, private companies, that's all they do, you know.
Yeah, that's right. And, well, the good thing is, though, too, is that we're still employing local people who have an attachment to the school district, and that's very important.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the relationship with the Slippery Rock University. It's close. It's more than just being across the street. Obviously, for you, it's close. That's your alma mater.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, we house their student teachers, and we give the university that great opportunity for so many student teachers here in the district. We also serve on a couple of their advisory councils as employees. We've served on panels for their student teachers that ask us questions in a Q&A type of format. And in return, the university, they'll offer students as tutors for our kids, even professional development opportunities for our staff, and we've even utilized some of the professors as guest speakers at our own professional development. So it really is a great partnership that we have with them.
Do school districts still need a library, Dr. Angelucci?
You know what? I can't see that ever going away. I will tell you that I do a lot of my reading on my phone, but I think kids need to hold books, to read from books, to carry books. I don't see that ever going away. There might be some people who disagree with me. I might be a little old-fashioned that way. And like I say, I like to read on my electronic device, but we need books. We definitely need books, and therefore we need libraries.
I think you need the space, too, sometimes, just a space to go and, you know, okay, and this is where I study, you know.
That's right. And no matter if it's an electronic device or a hardback book, and whether you call it a library or now they're calling them media centers, that's fine. You can call it what you want, but we know they're libraries for sure.
One final question. I noticed that, I don't know whether it's your truncated mission statement or the motto of the district, but it says on your website, Slippery Rock Area School District, cultivating knowledge and encouraging independence. I love that.
Absolutely. Thank you. And you know, that was developed by a committee of, we have a comprehensive planning committee that's made up of parents, teachers, administration. We had secretaries in there. We had students as part of that community. And each one of those words, Dave, was we took a lot of time on the exact wording that we thought would fit our district the best. And something that we're proud of is that we've been really working on getting our kids to be more independent thinkers, not being so quick to Google something or to run right up to their teacher and ask for the answer, because everything's such instant gratification these days. And we want them to grapple with their learning a little bit more. We believe in that problem-solving approach for sure.
That's fantastic. Listeners, stay tuned. On the next segment of the program, we're going to be talking with a man who's just written a memoir about being the son of a Navy man in Vietnam. Did you know that there were families of servicemen in Vietnam? It's a fascinating story. And it ties right in with the Ken Burns documentary, which started last night on PBS. His name is Les Arbuckle. We'll be talking to him in just a moment here on It's Your Turn. Meanwhile, we thank very much Dr. Alfonso Angelucci. He's the superintendent of the Slippery Rock School District. Doctor, great to meet you. And boy, you have a great school district there. So thanks for sharing information with us today.
Dave, thank you so much. It was my pleasure. Take care.
Sure. You too. So long now.
Bye-bye.
Nice man. I'd never talked to him before. Dr. Alfonso Angelucci. Well, as I mentioned, great conversation coming up about living in Saigon. Can you imagine living in Saigon when you're 14 years old in the early 60s? Coming of age in Saigon? Wow. What a story Les Arbuckle has to tell. And we'll talk. Did you watch the opening hour of the Ken Burns documentary last night? Yeah, I did too. It was fascinating. It was fascinating. So anyway, stick around. We'll take a quick break here and be back to talk with Les Arbuckle on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
At Butler Health System, there's more to medicine than the most advanced tools and techniques. There's the dedication to providing the most personal care, one that's shared by every member of our team, like renowned neurosurgeon Dr. Michael Horowitz.
I came to Butler because I wanted to practice medicine the way it's supposed to be done. It's truly about the patient. We get to know the people and what's important to them.
That dedication is why Butler Health System is trusted by our neighbors across the region and chosen by exceptional doctors who share our philosophy that the patient comes first, like orthopedic surgeon Charles Spingola.
I knew I'd have the tools and technology, but I also knew that there was a real commitment to genuine care. We don't treat medicine like an assembly line.
At Butler, we know what it takes to provide the very best of care. But more importantly, we know why we have to. Caring hands, remarkable minds. That's Butler Health System.
The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary, and the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler. Listeners, nice to have you with us on the It's Your Turn program today. And my name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest is Les Arbuckle, who joins us by telephone to talk about a book he's written that could hardly be more topical, I don't think. The name of the book is Saigon Kids. An American military brat comes of age in 1960s Vietnam. First of all, Les Arbuckle, nice to meet you. Boy, really nice to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
I say hardly more topical because of the Ken Burns marathon epic on Vietnam that's currently being broadcast on PBS.
Right. I saw that last night's episode, and learned a few things I didn't know about Vietnam. It's a very complex country, and it was a very complex situation there right from the beginning, so there's always something new to learn.
You know, it's funny because I had exactly the same reaction. I watched last night. It was the very first episode. And I knew quite a bit about Vietnam, but there were things I did not know, particularly about the complexities of the political situation at the time. I was aware that Ho Chi Minh had, come to the Americans numerous times asking for help, and unfortunately went the other way. But it was nicely explained. Well, what about your book now? Did you time the publication of your book to coincide with the Ken Burns series on TV, or was that just a happy accident?
Well, initially the book was going to be released on August 1st, and then my editor broke her arm. They pushed it back to August 15th, and then they said, what the heck, Ken Burns series is coming out. It'd be nice if we timed it to release about that same time. So they put it back to September 12th, and it should be getting into the stores right about now. Mm-hmm. It has to go to the distribution center at Barnes & Nobles and other places. But I have my copies here, but
I don't think it's in Barnes & Noble's quite yet. Should be here within the next day or two.
Well, I'm fortunate that I have a review copy in my hands that I just got a couple of days ago, so I haven't been able to read through the whole thing yet, but fascinating story. And I'm sure the first question our listeners would have is, military brat. You were a military brat. Your father was in the Navy at the time, just before the Vietnam War really heated up, correct?
Yes, yeah. The Navy found out that he had radio experience before, you know, after World War II, and they decided since they needed a radio station in Saigon, they would send him over to get a radio station started. And I didn't know this till recently, but he showed up at the Rex Hotel in downtown Saigon. All the equipment was there in large crates, and he unloaded all those crates, set up the broadcast equipment, and started broadcasting, and did it by himself alone for about three months before wow. Lieutenant Keitley showed up.
Wow.
So he was AFRS Saigon for the first few months. I don't know how he did it. I imagine he probably only did 8 to 10 hours a day, but that's got to be hard. I didn't know that, you know.
And this was Armed Forces Radio, right?
Yeah, Armed Forces Radio Station Saigon, or AFRS. And when we moved from there, we moved to the San Fernando Valley, and he worked in North Hollywood at the Armed Forces Radio and TV station. But by the time we left, they had a full roster of announcers and disc jockeys, so it got built up considerably the 2 years that he was there.
One of those announcers became quite famous, probably due to the film, right? Good Morning Vietnam.
Right, that was Adrian Cronauer, who is still alive and working in Washington, D.C. I think he's an attorney specializing in veterans affairs. And another famous disc jockey at that station was Pat Sajak.
Wow, I never knew that.
Who came along after Adrian Cronauer. I think Sajak came along about 66 or 67. And then there was Lee Hansen, who had the radio show in the 70s and early 80s called Alien Worlds. Hmm. He was also a disc jockey there in Saigon in 1963, 64.
Was your father still alive when the Robin Williams film came out about Adrian Cronauer?
Nope, he was not. My father died in 1976, and that movie came out sometime in the mid-1980s, mm-hmm. late 1980s. And he died of lung cancer in 1976. And I imagine the stress of leading a life like that, where you move constantly. He was also in World War II on an aircraft carrier, and in Korea, you know, well, in the Marshall Islands during the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
So he was involved basically in three different wars. So
let me get the timeline down on this for our listeners. Your father, Navy Chief Petty Officer Bryant Arbuckle, was sent to Vietnam. Do you know the exact year, Les?
Yes, it was the summer of 1962, and we had orders to go somewhere else, and they suddenly changed his orders and sent him to South Vietnam. There was no base and no military housing, so we had to wait about 6 months to so that he could find housing so the rest of us could come over. And my mother and my two brothers, Len and Lowell, all flew over in January of 63, leaving my oldest brother, Lee, behind. He was too old to go. He was not a dependent anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So we flew over in January of 63, and we're there until June of 64.
Now, refresh my memory on, I know that we had American advisors, they called them, in Vietnam before, actually several years before the fighting really got hot in terms of Americans. Would this have been the period that your father and then the family was over there when we just had American advisors?
Right. They called them advisors, but it, as I say in the book, it's kind of hard to be an advisor when the Viet Cong are trying to, you know, mm-hmm. shoot you. So
yeah.
Sometimes the advisors were actually involved in the fighting, although nobody really was willing to admit that. You know, our involvement was a lot deeper than the government was letting on to the American people. So
I tried to put quotes around advisors when I first used that word because I know that that's how they were officially referred to, but it was a little bit different than that. How old were you in January of 63 when you and your mom and your two brothers went over to Vietnam?
I was 13 and a half and knew pretty much everything and turned 14 in July of that year. So I was 13, 14 years old. Old enough to go out into the city on my own with my friends and get into trouble. So we were a bunch of little troublemakers. That's what we did. And we had plenty of time to do it because school was only 4 hours a day. So that left us a lot of time to go out and do what we wanted to in the city.
Was your residence right in Saigon at this time?
Yeah, yes, it was. The first place we lived was out a little farther on the outskirts near the airport at Tan Sanut. And then after about 6 months there, we moved to Phan Dinh Phung Street, which was our house was two blocks from the presidential palace. And it was a lot closer to the radio station, so my father could get to work a lot sooner. Seems like he was always being called in for some emergency, you know. But, yeah, we lived, there was no military base, so we lived, like all the other Americans, we lived among the people. We were surrounded by French, Vietnamese, Chinese people all the time.
We're talking, for listeners who may have joined us a couple of minutes late, with Les Arbuckle, who's written a fascinating a memoir called Saigon Kids. An American military brat comes of age in 1960s Vietnam. And I must say, Les, I didn't even realize that the Americans who were there very early before the fighting really got hot, I didn't realize they had family there. Until I got your book and started to read it, I didn't even know that dependents went over there.
Yeah, there had been dependents there since the 1950s. There are some kids who we consider to be Saigon kids who lived there in 1958, 57, 59. They didn't have an American school at that time, so they were mostly privately tutored or attended one of the French charter schools, I think. But the American community school got started around 1962, I believe, and had grades 1 through 12, and there were probably, I'd have to estimate, I'd say around 2,000 students, 2,000 to 3,000 maybe.
Oh, wow.
I could be wrong on that. I really don't know how many students were there, but I know we had a, you know, we had a band and a baseball team and dances and that kind of thing. You know, they tried to make it as normal as possible, but it's a little hard to do in that situation.
Yeah, and so you were able to go to that school in the time that you were there.
Yes, I was in the eighth grade and then the ninth grade.
Talk a little bit about your family life. We have a break coming up here, but I want to talk a little bit about that before we pause for a moment. You said your father was often called out to work at the radio station. That must have put quite a burden on your mom in terms of really managing the family life.
Yeah, my mom was pretty much a nervous wreck the whole time she was there. You know, being 13 years old, of course, I was never going to get killed. I was invulnerable and immortal, so it wasn't a problem. I didn't worry about it. But my mother knew better, and she was kind of high-strung anyway. And every time there was a terror attack or a bombing or some or a coup d'etat, my father would get called away to the radio station, and my mother would start fretting, you know, and worrying. And that really didn't stop the whole time we were there. She was always concerned, as she should have been, and as I would have been if I had any sense, but I didn't have any sense.
Did you have any trouble communicating? Were you able to, were any of the people there, did they speak enough English, or did you pick up any of their language?
I picked up some of their language. We also studied French in school. The Vietnamese, you know, most of the Vietnamese there spoke fluent French, and they were picking up English, so we usually spoke in a patois of languages. You know, we would speak French, English, and Vietnamese. You would use whatever words you knew from any of those languages to communicate.
Yeah, that's right. If people saw the opening episode of the Ken Burns documentary, you know that Vietnam was part of the French Indo-Chinese Empire, which included also Laos and Cambodia, I believe, at that time.
Right, right. Yeah, it's always been a complete mess over there. In general, now is probably about the most stable time that Vietnam has ever had, really. They were always getting invaded by the Chinese or the Dutch or the French or the English. There was always something going on.
We'll take a quick break. Fortunately, we have a couple of more minutes. Folks, we're able to chat with Les Arbuckle, author of Saigon Kids, an American military brat comes of age in 1960s Vietnam. We'll pick up our conversation with him right after these words.
Whether you're a competitive athlete or a weekend warrior, any injury that keeps you on the sidelines is not one worth having. The sports medicine specialist at Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers will help you get back into action so you can keep up your lifestyle. Our experts understand that the same treatments for competitive athletes can be used for those who just want to be able to stay active. They accept major insurance plans, including both Highmark and UPMC. Learn more about how you can get back on the field by visiting TriRiversMSK.com.
Are you looking for a new pharmacy after hearing news of Kmart closing? Celebrating 10 years of pharmacy care to the Butler community, locally owned Institute Hill Pharmacy can fill your prescriptions in just 10 minutes. We take all major insurance plans, stock a variety of over-the-counter medications, and pride ourselves on fast, friendly customer service. And we are excited to offer a $5 off coupon for any transferred prescription from Kmart customers. Some restrictions apply.
Check out Institute Hill Pharmacy on Facebook or stop by their location on East Jefferson Street.
Institute Hill Pharmacy. An old-fashioned pharmacy, just the way you remember. Welcome back on the It's Your Turn program today. My name is Dave Malarkey. If you're joining us a little bit late, that's fine. We're chatting with Les Arbuckle, the author of Saigon Kids, an American military brat comes of age in 1960s Vietnam. This would be tough, Les, I'm thinking to myself, in any time period, but boy, the 60s was a time of tumult. Even here in the United States, I mean, the pop culture was being radically reshaped by the Beatles and the sexual revolution and everything else that was going on. Did any of that touch you in Vietnam during this period, the early to mid-60s?
Yeah, quite a bit, actually. The thing that touched us the most, being in Vietnam, there was no TV, so we couldn't sit down in front of the TV and watch the evening news.
Mm-hmm.
But would read whatever newspaper, the two newspapers were The Observer and The Stars and Stripes, would read those when they came through. And then listening to the radio on AFRS, of course, would get some news that way. But it was the music that really, really hit us. You know, when the Beatles first came out, we were in Vietnam and all this, and the Beach Boys, you know, and all these surf groups came out. We were riveted by it. We wanted to know everything there was to know about it. And so when the sound of the 60s came on at 4 o'clock every day, so many of the kids, including myself, would be glued to the radio to hear whatever new rock and roll hits were out there. And that kept us connected to the United States. There was a bowling alley also there with a jukebox. And usually by the time anything got into the jukebox, it was already 6 months to a year old. But AFRS got the hits right away.
Were you allowed to grow your hair long, being a military brat? Were the girls allowed to adopt the popular hairstyles of the 60s?
Our styles, you know, because we were all military brats, styles were different from person to person depending on where they were from.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, a lot of the kids there were from the Arlington, Virginia, Washington, D.C. corridor, that area. And they were wearing, you know, chinos and Madras shirts, you know, very Ivy League type of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of the kids, like my best friend was from California, and he dressed more like what they would call, what we learned to call, a greaser, you
mm-hmm.
know, a hodan.
Yes, yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. And then this kid from Malibu showed up. And he was dressed, you know, with Dewey Weber surfboard T-shirts and blue jeans and desert boots, you know, and had his hair combed, you know, and he was like, you know, dude, what's up with this school, man, you know? And everybody was very impressed by him because he represented the co culture we had left behind that we'd only just heard a little bit about in Life magazine or on the radio. And all of a sudden, this kid shows up, and he not only spoke the new lingo from Southern California, but he dressed in that particular style and had that attitude. So he was popular right away.
Must have been quite an experience. We saw, or even those of us who have gone back and read about this era, there were magazine covers. I think Look and Life were still being published back in those days. And, of course, we had television news. There were some pretty shocking things that we saw that had occurred in Vietnam, including Buddhist monks setting themselves on fire in protest in the middle of the street. Did you ever see any of that horrible stuff yourself, personally?
I saw a little bit of the first one. Quang Duc, who immolated himself at not too far from Saigon Market there. I was on the way home in a motorcycle. Saw a little bit of that from a distance. And then a week or two later, my friend Spike and I call him Spike in the book. That's not his real name. But we went to the temple, the Siloy Temple, and got a tour of the temple from one of the monks, and we saw a little altar with a glass vase or jar with his heart in it.
Wow.
And that, you know, I was able to stand there and look at that for a while. So that had much more of an effect on me than the initial immolation, which when I saw it, I wasn't even sure really what it was. You know, I thought it looked like a person burning. But, you know, the demonstrations were constant, and there had been dummies of Ngo Dinh Diem burnt in protests before, so thought it might be something like that.
You have dedicated your book, Saigon Kids, Les, to your parents, and also to Sister Kenneth Regan, who taught me to read and write. That sounds like an Irish nun somewhere. Am I correct on that?
Well, yes. She's still alive. She was my teacher at Our Lady of Sorrows Catholic School when I was in first grade, and I was not a good student. And she took care of that. She made me stay after school every day for the entire first grade. Literally. Mm. I do not exaggerate. Every day for the entire first grade.
Wow.
And she taught me to read and write. And she is still alive.
Wow.
And I talked to her about 4 or 5 months ago.
That's wonderful.
So she's 90-something years old now. But it was because of her that I didn't become a complete idiot.
You have chapters in there. Again, listeners, it's a hard book to pigeonhole. I wouldn't even want to try to, but it's a memoir of growing up. But can you imagine this, this period of your life when so much else is going on, being in Saigon, for goodness sakes? You have a chapter on dating. You have chapters on other stuff. I guess, I'm looking at the dates that you were there. You would have been there one New Year's Eve, and you dedicated a whole chapter to that. Was that particularly memorable, Les Arbuckle?
Oh, that was the first New Year's Eve. I didn't spend it home with Mom. You know, my father was a drummer, so he was out playing gigs on New Year's Eve. But me and my brothers would stay home with my mother and would make popcorn and, you know, maybe would stay up till the ball fell in Times Square and maybe would fall asleep before then. But that was the first New Year's Eve where we didn't do that. Me and my friend Spike went out on the town and got in trouble.
You, I want to talk a little bit about, it's a short period of time we have left here. You were in the military yourself. In fact, you're quite an accomplished musician. I see here you played in one of the Army bands. Our radio station has brought several of those to our town over the years. And my, oh my, you must have been pretty good to get into that band.
Well, you know, I didn't really want to be in the Army, but I didn't want to be carrying a rifle in Vietnam. And I was 1A for the draft. So I joined the Army and got a guarantee for the band at Fort Monroe, Virginia, and went to the School of Music there and stayed at Fort Monroe my entire time. And it was an alternative. I cheated the draft by joining the Army. I wanted to come to Berkeley in Boston but didn't have the money, so I figured I'll go and I'll get the GI Bill, which I did, and then I went to Berkeley later. But I really didn't want to be in the Army. When I got in the Army, I realized that more than ever, that I really was tired of moving. I didn't want to go anywhere. I didn't want to be in the Army. The whole military thing, I was sick of it. I didn't hate the Army. I just hated being in the Army. Hmm. And I was not the best soldier, you know. It was just, the Army was just like, instead of rebelling against my father and mother, now I had the Army to rebel against, another authority figure. And it was a very tough time for me in the Army. I didn't like it. Well, of course, most of the people that were in the Army at that time didn't like it either, so I was not alone.
Okay, let me ask you one more question, because it kind of ties into what you're just talking about here. Have you been able to, or do you, in your memoir, compare the Vietnam War as to how you were seeing it when you were over there when you were 14, as opposed to now or in recent years?
Not really. You know, I tried when writing the memoir to relate the war as I saw it at the time through the eyes of a 14-year-old. I've read Stanley Karnow's book and all kinds of books about Vietnam, seen various movies and documentaries. But I didn't want to put an adult's perspective on it because I wasn't there as an adult, for one thing. And the book really, it's not really about politics as much as it is my experiences in Vietnam as a 13, 14-year-old kid. And my friends, you know, my friends and the community there, what we experienced, what news we knew of, and what our perspective was. I have friends who lived there much longer than I did, who had a lot more perspective on the politics and everything that happened, but they never wrote about it, so...
Let me give just one testimonial here as we wrap up. And this comes from Lee Hansen. And Les spoke about him earlier in our conversation. He was one of the air personalities on Armed Forces Radio Saigon. Lee Hansen says about this book, "Arbuckle cleverly captures the sights, the sounds, the language, and the smells of Saigon during a unique period of turmoil. I know because I was there." The book is called Saigon Kids, An American Military Brat Comes of Age in 1960s Vietnam, by Les Arbuckle. He's been our guest on It's Your Turn. Les, boy, what a story. What a book. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Dave. Anytime.
Sure, sure. So long now.
So long. Bye-bye.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 6464. The pick 3 is 974. The pick 4, 3051, and the pick 5 is 11154. The wild ball for each of those is 3. The treasure hunt is 2, 12, 21, 26, and 29. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $30,000.
I wasn't prepared to be a caregiver to Mom, but a little over a year ago, we realized she couldn't take care of herself without our help. And, well, how could I not be there for her? I had no idea how hard it would be and just what I would need to know. Things I never thought of, like how to improve her mood and, even for me, ways to stay positive. Luckily, I found the Caregiving Resource Center from AARP. It had articles about the basics that got me started, but also information about the hurdles I was facing in this new role. I could even connect with experts and hear from others who had been in my place. I know this road we're on isn't an easy one, but I'm really happy to have the extra help for her and for me. Caregiving Resource Center at aarp.org/caregiving. Articles, tips, and tools to help you both care for your loved one and care for yourself. This message is brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Attention Alexa users, did you know you can listen to WISR through your Amazon Echo? That's right. Alexa, play WISR.
Playing WISR.
WISR is proud to provide you with the music you love on the devices you use. Radio, computer, tablet, smartphone, and now your Amazon Alexa-enabled device. WISR, we're everywhere you are. Just ask Alexa.
We thank our guests today. Folks, Saigon Kids, Les Arbuckle's memoir is really, really good. It's funny at times, poignant at times. Very good. Thanks to him. And we certainly thank Dr. Alfonso Angelucci, superintendent of the Slippery Rock Area School District, who chatted with us, and Pennsylvania State Police Troop D, Trooper Dan Keston, who explained, actually, I learned quite a bit about child safety seats and what's the law in Pennsylvania and what you have to do to make sure your kids are safe. This is National Child Passenger Safety Week, and now through Saturday. So thanks to our guest tomorrow on the program. It will be an Ask the Veterinarian Day. Dr. Dennis Damon from Suburban Animal Clinic will be with us on tomorrow's program. And we have lots more good things planned for you for later in the week. So enjoy the rest of your Monday. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Dave Malarkey on WISR 680 Butler.
Butler County wakes up with Dave.